I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The second impeachment trial for former President Trump begins later today. He's charged with incitement of insurrection after a violent mob of his supporters stormed the Capitol on January 6 while lawmakers were certifying the election of Joe Biden for president, threatening to kill Vice President Pence and House Speaker Pelosi. Coming up, the case against Trump, his defense, and the constitutional issues at stake. President Trump has two new lawyers to defend him in the Senate trial, including Bruce Castor. While not well known nationally, Castor has been a familiar and at times controversial figure in the Philadelphia area. He's a former Montgomery County District Attorney and County Commissioner who was acting Pennsylvania Attorney General for a very brief time. Some 15 years ago, he declined to prosecute Bill Cosby when accused of sexual assault by Temple University employee Andrea Constand. Later, when Cosby faced criminal charges, his defense team called Castor to the stand as a witness to defend his decision. Reporter Laura Benshoff covered that trial for WHYY and joins us to fill us in on some of the details with Bruce Castor. She covers stories of statewide interest for Keystone Crossroads and for WHYY. And Laura Benshoff, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's good to be
here.
You're
very welcome. Do we know why Bruce Castor agreed to defend Donald Trump, knowing that his, meaning Trump's previous attorneys basically quit just a couple of weeks ago?
Well, we know that when asked about it by my colleague Katie Meyer, Castor said, "You don't say no to the president." He said he would do the same thing for Bill Clinton. But, you know, beyond that, in terms of his political ambitions or what he hopes to get out of it, I think that's not clear yet.
I'd like to talk a little bit about his career, and it's actually quite fascinating. He was a district attorney for Montgomery County from 2000 to 2008. What was his reputation as the top prosecutor in that county?
By all accounts, Castor was good at his job when he was district attorney. He was aggressive. He was charismatic. He prosecuted some very high-profile local cases, and that kept him in the news a lot. And it became clear that he had political ambitions beyond being a local district attorney. He ran or attempted to run for statewide office in 2004, but didn't make it very far. So he stayed as the Montgomery County District Attorney all the way from 2000 to 2008.
And he put a number of murderers behind bars, correct, Laura?
That's right. One year he got 5 convictions for first-degree murder. He also prosecuted a very high-profile domestic violence case against a University of Pennsylvania professor whose last name is Rob. He would go on the national TV news sometimes to talk about these cases because the details would be so salacious. He was a very telegenic local prosecutor.
He is described by you and frankly by everyone else whose articles are about Bruce Castor as liking the limelight, that, you know, if there was a camera there and the case involved Bruce Castor, chances he was there as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, I covered him when he ran for DA again and during the Cosby trial. And at that point, he already had a reputation as a local prosecutor, you know, like I said, with bigger ambitions. And so one way to be appealing to voters is to just get your name out there over and over again. And it's something that a lot of ambitious prosecutors will do. They'll sort of take, you know, the work that they're doing every day in a district attorney's office and make sure that it's packaged nicely and it can get on, you know, on TV, basically, so that the people know you're there, that you're there defending or prosecuting the bad guys, and that's a pretty helpful platform if you're looking to boost your profile statewide.
Indeed. Let me just ask you about his tenure as a county commissioner in Montgomery County, what that was like, and then we'll talk about Cosby.
Sure. So he ran for county commission in 2008 and won, and this was a sort of interesting time in Montgomery County. You know, in the last few years, we've talked a lot about the blue wave in the suburbs, and Montgomery County is now very solidly Democrat. Castor's a Republican, and at the time, Republicans still held sway, and they had a 2/3 majority on the county commission. But because Castor had such a contentious relationship with the other Republican, he was essentially iced out of having any role in his first term. So the other Republican councilperson teamed up with their Democratic council person to make all decisions together and essentially ice out Bruce Castor. And he was very vocal about not liking that and was in the press again a lot. And this was a very public spat. Castor stayed on the county commission and won again a second term. And at that point, the balance of power switched to Democrats in Montgomery County. And he actually had a much easier time working with Leslie Richards and Josh Shapiro, who are now head of SEPTA and the attorney general, who had both spent time as county commission. So, you know, Castor has a sort of prickly history because he has had these very public feuds with people in his party. But then he also praises people like Josh Shapiro. So it's a kind of you can't draw the political lines very clearly for who he is going to gel with or not.
Well, let's go back to when he was district attorney, and this was when Andrea Constand, she was a Temple University employee at the time, she accused Bill Cosby of sexual assault. Why did Bruce Castor, why did he decline to prosecute the case? What was his explanation?
His explanation at the time, which he wrote up and put out in a press release, was that he did not think he could secure a conviction. You know, the bar of, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt is hard to meet in a criminal case. So he basically said, I don't think the evidence is there, and I would like to free up, you know, Mr. Cosby and Ms. Constand to go through a civil case. You know, in civil court, the burden of proof isn't so high, and he seemed to think she could get a large settlement, which in the end she did, by going through a civil suit. Where it gets a little bit thorny is that Castor also made some statements to the press that seemed to be impugning Ms. Constand's credibility. And he was later sued by her over those statements, sued for defamation. So he definitely was a big character, even in not prosecuting Bill Cosby.
And in when she, and this gets a little complicated, but when she sued, she won, correct? When she sued Castor?
I believe she did, but that's a very good question. I mean, the way she ultimately won was there was a criminal prosecution brought, right, and Bill Cosby was convicted. So all of Castor's, you know, predictions that it was an unwinnable case, and that's why he did not charge, you know, this incredibly famous comedian and entertainer, turned out not to be true.
In fact, Castor did take the stand and was called by Cosby's defense attorneys. What did he say on the stand?
He defended, you know, his decision, and he also sort of talked about this agreement that he said he had with Bill Cosby and with Cosby's lawyer at the time, who by the time the trial happened was deceased. So he basically said, look, I didn't think this was a winnable case. I made the decision. I, acting as the sovereign of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I'm paraphrasing his actual words here, made this decision that I would promise Bill Cosby that he would never be prosecuted criminally, so that he would feel free to go participate in a civil trial and, you know, Ms. Constand could get basically a financial payment. You know, I made these decisions. I followed the law. It was just really fascinating to see someone take that case. And the other issue with his argument was there was no document. There was no paper trail for this agreement that he claimed that he had with Cosby beyond a public press release that didn't exactly say it in those terms. So it was a very confusing episode. It's now at the center of Cosby's attempt to appeal his conviction. It's one of the legal issues his team says, you know, went one way in the trial, but really should have gone the other way. So it, frankly, you know, Bruce Castor's testimony is still in play, you know, many, many years later.
It's so fascinating, Laura, because all the profiles of Bruce Castor in the last couple of days, almost the headline is, you know, the prosecutor who declined to prosecute Bill Cosby.
Yeah, it's definitely stuck with him. It was a liability when he ran to try to become district attorney again. You know, he was slammed in negative ads for not prosecuting Cosby. And, you know, with the benefit of having sat through two of those trials and seeing how they unfolded, you know, it does seem like a very unusual decision, the way that it was handled. But also, when those allegations came to light, it was 2005. It was long before the Me Too movement. The context seemed to be pretty different But yeah, it's definitely, it has clung to him ever since he declined to prosecute.
And one little sidebar, and then I do want to talk about the fact that he will face off against another Montgomery County lawyer, Madeline Dean, but he did run for attorney general. He lost to Tom Corbett, and just for, what, about 2 weeks, he was Pennsylvania attorney general?
That's right. Back when Kathleen Kane was charged with felonies for her misuse of that office and eventually convicted, he was sort of tapped through an unusual agreement where she would, I think, still be directing the office, but because of her legal entanglement, she was not allowed to do certain things. She was not allowed to make certain decisions or authorize certain things. So she sort of tapped him to help do that. And then when she was convicted, he was attorney general for a couple weeks. But it was clearly not what sort of the powers that be wanted. And so he was quickly ushered out after that short stint.
And just a couple of minutes, but it's kind of fascinating that we've got these two pretty well-known, at least locally well-known, attorneys who will be facing off starting this afternoon in the U.S. Senate. Talk to us just briefly, if you could, Laura, about Madeline Dean and versus Bruce Castor.
Well, Madeline Dean came into the House of Representatives in this blue wave that happened after President Trump was elected. A lot of, you know, women, suburban women in the Philadelphia area were newly galvanized. She'd been a township or borough council person in Abington, and then she'd been in the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania, the state legislature. And so she's still a pretty, you know, in her first couple of terms, but she's really become a central figure because she's helping to lead this impeachment trial. And she was there during the January 6th insurrection, and I was able to interview her later that night. And I think, you know, she's coming at this both as a lawyer and as someone who personally lived through the trauma of that event, which I think should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, she is one of the impeachment managers for the Democrats. I interviewed her as well, Laura. What did she tell you about that particular day, January 6th?
You know, when I was talking to her, her location was still private. It was still one of, you know, in the touch and go moments when people weren't sure if the violence was fully over yet. And there's a pretty well circulated photo of her now sort of being ushered out of the chamber with these kind of provisional gas masks that they gave the representatives over her face. And, you know, she sounded resolved, but she definitely sounded disturbed and shaken having gone through what she did. And, you know, I think at that point, and she's made statements since then as well, that, you know, there's no doubt in her mind that President Trump was responsible for inciting that violence. Now, obviously, that's what's going to be up for debate in the impeachment trial. But, you know, as someone who lived through it, that was her take.
Well, Laura Benchoff, thank you, as always, for joining us today in Radio Time. She covers stories of statewide interest for Keystone Crossroads and for WHYY. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And coming up, we've got a lawyer waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about the impeachment trial. It starts in a couple of hours and what to expect. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mats Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Later today, Donald Trump will face a second impeachment trial with House managers arguing that he was, quote, singularly responsible for the deadly attack on the Capitol on January 6th. In their 80-page brief, they argued that he incited a mob of his supporters even before the rally that day, fraudulently claiming that the election was stolen from him. Quoting from the brief, the House manager said, if provoking an insurrectionary riot against a joint session of Congress after losing an election is not an impeachable offense, it is hard to imagine what would be. Trump's defense lawyers argue that you can't impeach a former president and that Trump's words are protected by the First Amendment. Senators who were victims of the attack are jurors in this trial and will listen to the evidence, much of which has already been viewed by the public. The Democrats will need 17 Republicans to convict Trump and bar him from office. Joining us is Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, wrote a book called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim Whaley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kim, there are a lot of legal and constitutional issues that I want to walk you through for our listeners. But starting with a broad question, what is at stake in this trial?
At stake are a number of things. One is really the legitimacy of the impeachment clause itself or clauses. Impeachment's mentioned six times in the Constitution, which, given how terse the document is, I think just underscores how important the framers thought it was as a lever of accountability for the office of the presidency. And I think it's not just a rhetorical argument to say if something like January 6th doesn't give rise to an impeachable offense, how meaningful is impeachment going forward? And I think the second piece that's really at stake is sort of if there isn't accountability for what happened on January 6th, are we going to move into an environment in the United States where every 4 years, if there's a willing politician in the White House to incite some kind of trauma and potential violence to upset the peaceful handover of power, are we going to see that rather than like we saw in 2000 with former Vice President Gore, who lost in Florida, and as Vice President peacefully gaveled in, you know, George Bush as president, understanding that that was, at least his view, the best interest of all of Americans. So it's setting a weird precedent and one that could be quite troubling moving forward if politicians think, listen, really stirring the pot in a way that could lead to violence and injury is a pathway to staying in power.
And just to underscore what you were saying there, and no president that I'm aware of has ever refused the results of an election until Donald Trump. Is that correct, Kim?
Yes, that's my understanding as well. And, you know, people, I think, talk a lot about the Constitution, but it's important to keep in mind, we hear a lot about norms. You know, the Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's like, you know, a contract you might have to have your lawn mowed or something. It doesn't itself enforce itself. It requires a couple things. One is, you know, mechanisms for to enforce violations, so people know that if they cross boundaries, there'll be a consequence. That's what's at stake. And also just an understanding that people will just comply with it out of respect for the document, just like we all stop at stop signs, not necessarily because we expect to get a ticket, but because that's just what we do in an ordered society. And I think Donald Trump really upset that established norm that has been handed down from presidency to presidency, that the framers frankly thought would be part and parcel of anyone who took office, is just respect for the office and a willingness to abide by norms of conduct for the sake of the republic itself.
One of the arguments from Trump's lawyers is that you can't impeach a president who has already left office. One of the punishments for impeachment is that you lose your job as president of the United States. Their argument is that he has already left, even though he was impeached while he was president, but he's no longer president. What is the counter argument to that, Kim?
Well, there are a number of them. One is that Secretary of War William Belknap in the 1800s was tried after he left office when he was impeached in office. So there's historical precedent that undermines that argument. The second is that the Constitution provides for a second remedy, not just removal. It's expressed in the Constitution that on conviction for on an impeachment charge, the individual who's convicted can be banned from holding public office going forward. So that mechanism of accountability is still live. It's not, as lawyers would say, mooted out by the fact that the president is no longer in office. I think the third argument is really just a common sense one. The impeachment managers are calling it the January exception, that there is no January exception, which is this, which is if it's true that you could never hold a trial for a president, even if they're impeached in office, then it is a green light for any president to commit high crimes and misdemeanors at will the last few weeks of office, because it would be, you know, foreclosed from actually holding that person accountable through impeachment. And as I indicated, six times it's mentioned in the Constitution. The framers really thought this was going to function. So I think this kind of delicate, nuanced constitutional argument doesn't hold up to basic common sense, particularly in light of the fact that the argument, the last impeachment of Donald Trump, made by Republicans in the Senate, was that we have to wait for an election. So if there's an election impending, can't impeach. If the election happened, can't impeach. Of course, that would just wipe out the six references to the impeachment clause altogether, which wouldn't make sense as a matter of basic, just, you know, textualist reading of the document.
And I do want to talk about this whole issue about the First Amendment. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And then I do want to play a clip from that rally that the president hosted on January 6th. Kim Whaley, our guest, she's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, joining us to help us understand what's ahead. The impeachment trial of President Trump will get underway in just a couple of hours. Of course, takes place in the U.S. Senate. Let me just play. It's about a minute, but I want to play this. This seems like this is the heart of the argument coming from both the House managers and also from Trump's lawyers, having to do with what he said at this January 6th rally. Kim, let's give it a listen, and then we'll talk afterwards.
And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. Our exciting adventures and boldest endeavors have not yet begun. My fellow Americans, for our movement, for our children, and for our beloved country, and I say this, despite all that's happened, the best is yet to come. So we're going to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I love Pennsylvania Avenue. And we're going to the Capitol, and we're going to try and give, you know, the Democrats are hopeless. They're never voting for anything, not even one vote. But we're going to try and give our Republicans, the weak ones, because the strong ones don't need any of our help. We're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country.
And that, of course, is President Trump speaking at that rally on January 6th. Kim, the words that seem to be being fought about in this impeachment trial, we fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. The House managers are saying that's an incitement to riot. Trump's attorneys are saying, look, politicians talk about fights all the time. They don't really mean it. Can you speak to how we're supposed to understand this language?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is, and I know we'll get to the First Amendment, but it is a crime at the federal level and at many states to incite a riot. So notwithstanding free speech, there's a line that can be crossed, and the argument here is that it was crossed. Now, this is an impeachment. What that means is it's essentially about a personnel action. It's not putting somebody in jail. So some would argue that the same level of proof, preponderance or proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which applies in a criminal context, does not apply here because it's essentially a personnel action against someone who has the office of the presidency. So we have to keep that in mind in terms of the burden of proof. His lawyers are saying, as you indicate, listen, he was just making a political speech. And they also go out of their way in the briefs to say the fact that crimes were committed by, you know, now we have, you know, dozens, if not more, of people that engaged in the riots who were arrested and could go to prison, right? If that happens, that's up to them. It had absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump, kind of leaving those people out in the cold on their own and saying and disavowing that relationship. The House manager's argument is, listen, you can't look at just what that particular clip. You've got to think of the course of action going, stretching back to July, and ask, would those people have been there but for the lies? And I say the lies because we know there were over 60 lawsuits where the judges allowed the Trump campaign to present evidence of fraud. There was no evidence of fraud. Courts are bound by those rules. So the lie that this was a fraudulent election, the lie, frankly, that Mike Pence and the Congress had the constitutional authority on January 6th to take the vote away from the Electoral College and hand it to Donald Trump. Without those lies, there would never have been the riots on January 6th. And they also will say, you have to look after that speech and to his conduct following it when he said, listen, we'll march down Pennsylvania Avenue. And then the crowd got whipped up and there were cries to, quote, hang Mike Pence. And that after those you know, really threatening calls came out, Donald Trump tweeted something about Mike Pence being a coward. So with knowledge that the crowd was on the verge of violence and potential murder, you know, at least either saying that, Donald Trump stoked that sentiment with a tweet. So the House impeachment manager's argument is, listen, there's a long course of conduct, but for Donald Trump, it would not have happened what happened on January 6th and the five deaths. Donald Trump's team is saying all he was doing was making a political speech like lots of politicians. And if people got out of hand, that's on them. It has no Donald Trump bears no responsibility for that reaction.
And they're also making the argument is that he is, this would be Donald Trump's attorneys, that he is protected by the First Amendment. Take that apart for us. And then I do want to read some comments from our listeners.
Yeah, so as I indicated, the First Amendment argument is overblown, at least, you know, to some degree how it's being packaged, because we don't have unlimited rights to free speech. We, you and me, regular people, we can be put in jail for our speech if we incite a riot within the meaning of the criminal laws, for example, if we shout fire in a crowded theater, if we possess images of children that are pornographic. All of these things, even though there be speech, there are limits on it. I think there's a couple things that are special about a president. One is that, again, there's an impeachment clause in the Constitution, and that's a personnel action. And many scholars, I think 144 or so, signed on to some kind of missive to the Washington Post saying, listen, impeachment is a special thing. It's not bound by the First Amendment in the same way, which, of course, came after the impeachment clause. It was passed later. Second is, you know, Donald Trump on January 6th had more power than anyone else really in the United States. He had the full force of the military. He had federal law enforcement at his fingertips. The Bill of Rights, which the First Amendment is part of, is about government bullying little people, government making violating rights of regular people. If that happens, you can go to court and get a court to sort of force government to stop that. And Donald Trump was in a very, very different posture. I think the last piece is that there is case law that if a federal official or employee is taking an action in their official capacity and speaking in a way that implicates their office, that speech isn't protected in the same way. So say I'm a federal employee, I say something in connection with my work, I can be fired if I misstate something, for example, whereas if I speak as a private citizen, my First Amendment rights would kick in. I think some would argue, listen, he was speaking as president in a way that was false, that was problematic about this alleged stolen election. That is factually inaccurate, and so he can be held accountable for speaking as president in a way that was distorting the facts and also the how the mechanism of the peaceful transfer of power is supposed to work on January 6th.
Let me read a couple of comments, and I want to ask you about witnesses. You wrote something about that, but Paul says, even if the Constitution said it was completely fine to prosecute a president after they left office, the Republicans would still acquit Trump. It is still his party. An email from Susan, what are we able to do if the president commits some heinous act in the last days he is in office? Do they just walk away with no consequences, something you just referenced? And a question from Jay, why can't the Senate Republicans vote by secret ballot, which would increase the likelihood that they would feel safe to vote their conscience and convict Donald Trump? Let me just put those questions out there, because you had a really interesting piece about witnesses. I think this was in the Bulwark, about witnesses. And I don't know whether they're going to the House managers are going to bring in witnesses or not. It looks like there's going to be a lot of video testimony from some of these videos that we have all watched. You do make an argument for witnesses and witnesses who were there in the White House while the president was reportedly watching TV and kind of feeling very happy, if I can use that word, about what was happening at the Capitol.
Right. So if this were a criminal trial, again, higher burden of proof, there would likely be a required showing that Donald Trump didn't drum up the crowd by mistake, that he intended and knew this was going to happen. And so in light of that standard, even though it's not a criminal trial, if the objective is to really potentially change the minds of the public, which would then put pressure potentially on the Republican caucus that could vote to convict, then my argument is we need to know more than what we've already seen in on videotape, even though there's a massive amount of evidence. And prosecutors would say, listen, it's a dream to have this kind of blow-by-blow video and audio tape of everything that happened on January 6th. So I think in an ideal world, we would hear from people around Donald Trump. We would hear from people in his campaign reportedly that were involved in financing and organizing the January 6th protests. Were they aware of the online traffic and the January 5th FBI warning that there was going to be, quote, war, something akin to that attempted on January 6th. Also,
Kim, if you don't mind, just only because we're almost up on a break here,
sure.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kim Whaley, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, and we're getting a quick preview of the upcoming impeachment trial. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're getting a preview of the upcoming proceedings that are going to take place in the U.S. Senate, the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. We're going to look at, we are looking at some of the constitutional arguments at stake. And again, Kim Whaley, our guest, she's a professor at the University of Baltimore Law School and wrote a book called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim, I do want to play another clip. I know you were right in the middle of your response there, but this is a leaked audio of then-President Trump's phone call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. This is on January 2nd, in which he urges Raffensperger to, quote, find 11,780 votes. Let's just listen. It's very short, and then I just want to give you a chance to follow up.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
Kim, let me go back to you and just pick up on a couple of things. What the president is charged with is incitement for insurrection. But this phone call does, to some degree, get to the president's state of mind. And everything that his lawyers are saying is that he believes that he won the election, even though everything, every fact, every court, everything that happened in the U.S. government says that he did not. If we're talking about incitement, how important is something like state of mind?
Well, again, at a criminal trial, it would be really important. It is raised, so I would say because this is a political trial, it's important to change minds. It is also relevant. I think the question there is, I mean, you know, was he actually looking for a fourth recount, or was he actually asking Raffensperger to commit fraud, to actually to use his words to steal the election from Joe Biden? I think the latter is probably a fair inference from that quote or that tape. But this is another place where the Democrats could call Mr. Raffensperger or others that were on the call to dig into that, but that would drag out the trial. That would invite Republicans to sort of maybe reopen the legitimacy of the election. There are a lot of political implications for that are problematic. But 2 points to our last two callers' questions. One, sure. On a secret ballot, I do agree that if there were a secret ballot, we might have a conviction, because we know when Liz Cheney, censure of her was put but to secret ballot, more Republicans went in favor of supporting her, but that would require publicly a vote on secret ballot. I'm not sure why that hasn't happened, but I believe it is probably political. The second question is, what do you do then about rogue presidents at the end of the term? I would just say, be careful who you vote for, and wow, base your votes on facts and integrity in office and willingness to color within the lines. Also, of course, he could still be prosecuted at the local level. It could be prosecuted through Joe Biden's Justice Department. And I did a piece in Politico recently, Congress could pass a law implementing another part of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, which is a post-Civil War amendment that was designed to keep Confederates out of office. And Congress could give a cause of action. It would be challenged in court, but essentially allowing someone who is on the ballot with a future Donald Trump to try to get him off the ballot, to enjoin him on the grounds that the Constitution forbids it under the 14th Amendment.
You mentioned Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney. Let me just play a short clip of what she told anchor Chris Wallace. This was on Fox News Sunday, in which she frankly reiterated her criticism of former President Donald Trump and said that he should be impeached. Let's just give it a quick listen.
What we already know is enough for his impeachment. What we already know does constitute the gravest violation of his oath of office by any president in the history of the country. And this is not something that we can simply look past or pretend didn't happen or try to move on. We've got to make sure this never happens again.
And again, that was Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney. Kim, let me just go to the afternoon of January 6th. This was after the attack on the Capitol begins. And you had mentioned something that the president tweeted. I'll just quote here. This was at 2:24. Mike Pence, this is the president, then president. Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands the truth. And it really wasn't until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then really until 6 o'clock in the afternoon, that he tells his supporters to essentially go home. When you look at the events of that afternoon and what the president either didn't do or did do, do you see that as impeachable or as part of this argument for impeachment?
Yes. I mean, I think that's part of the argument that, you know, in the article of impeachment for insurrection, they also cite Article 2 of the Constitution, which has two critical provisions of the president's power, the Take Care Clause, that he shall execute the law, number one, and that he shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And they argue, listen, you know, in not sort of encouraging these people to go home and in not taking steps as commander-in-chief and as a chief executive to sort of quiet this process, that he was abdicating his constitutional responsibilities under Article 2. And I should just say, too, Marty, I mean, I live a few miles from the Capitol, and I've been down there many, many, many times. You know, Washington knows how to do law enforcement in a major rally, and certainly one where it's expected there could be some potential violence. And the lack of law enforcement presence there was really stunning. We also know Larry Hogan, Maryland governor, has reported that he wanted authority from the Defense Department, which, of course, answered to Donald Trump in the moment, to release the National Guard in Maryland. And he had to wait 2 hours, reportedly, before he got that authorization. So I think there's a big question where, not only why didn't he send Donald Trump send his supporters home earlier, but where was his finger on the lever of law enforcement to protect the legislative branch? And, you know, this is probably going to be a too quick trial, frankly, for whatever reason, political reasons. I think we need a 9/11 style commission to get to the bottom of how there was that spectacular meltdown in law enforcement that allowed domestic terrorists to climb and overtake the Capitol and kill people.
Well, yes, we know that one police officer, I guess he was a Capitol police officer, died as a result of his injuries. We're hearing more. Someone's going to lose an eye. There were multiple injuries. And when you look at some of these videos, it's really pretty horrifying to see the kind of violence meted out on these security officials.
Right. I mean, there's heroic measures put in place by some of these people. I mean, the officer who died was bludgeoned with a fire extinguisher. We also know that these people knew where to go in the Capitol, that they got into some of the inner offices of our members of Congress, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera. And some people I know who've worked many years on the Capitol say, listen, it's a labyrinth. You kind of need to know your way around. There's reports that doors were open from the inside. These are questions of national security. They're not red versus blue, Republican versus Democrat questions, because we do need to have a safe and secure Capitol, not just for our members and their staffers. I mean, there were regular, you know, young people and people of all ages there working on behalf of the American people, but also because it sets a message internationally that, you know, we don't know what we're doing when it comes to protecting our most sacred offices in the country at a moment where we're transferring power. This was a sort of a green light for terrorists and those across the globe that don't support American democracy, that we're weak and we're vulnerable. And so I think the Congress needs to be very clear to the entire planet that we are going to get to the bottom of this, and this won't be allowed to happen again, at least as a measure of law enforcement. We'll just have to see.
A question from Julia. If legislators are questioning whether it's constitutional to impeach a former president, why hasn't the question been posed to the judicial branch? Why? And do you think it should be? And do you think it would end up there, Kim?
Well, I do think if it were ever legitimately before the judicial branch, it would go all the way to the Supreme Court. The issue is that there is Article 3, which establishes the federal judiciary, has basically a key to the courthouse door. That is, you have to show a live case or controversy. There has to be a dispute between two discrete parties to even get into federal court. They couldn't be asked to just give advice. That would be considered unconstitutional, more like a politician or a legislator. So the only way this could come up is, say, if Donald Trump were actually convicted, he were precluded. They were basically to say, listen, you can't run for office. He runs for office and then claims that he is allowed, or somebody else were trying to kick him off the ballot, then you'd have a dispute. You'd have a dispute between Donald Trump and another candidate. That could go to the court. But there's really no mechanism to get this in the federal courthouse door right now. So it's really the United States Congress that is acting as the judges here. And the fact that they voted down Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky's motion to dismiss the indictment, or the article of impeachment by virtue of the fact that Donald Trump is no longer in office, I think that really functions in this moment as the ruling on the constitutionality of the trial, which I think that's established. It's going forward, and therefore, as a matter of precedent and as a matter of the will of the United States Congress, it is constitutional.
Here's an email from Thomas. Even if the First Amendment doesn't technically protect a president from impeachment, it seems reasonable for jurors to believe that their moral commitments to freedom of speech require them to acquit. I mean, that's an interesting, potential test that will be before some of these more reluctant senators.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting when you think about the First Amendment, and you just mentioned Liz Cheney, right, and the effort to censure her, and I think the GOP in Wyoming censured her. I mean, that is protected speech for legislatures. Legislators. That is, if she speaks based on her political views relating to something as important as the legitimacy of President Trump's actions on January 6th, that is protected speech under Supreme Court precedent. But sort of speaking in a way that causes violence, that is not protected speech. So I agree with the caller that we have to be very careful to not tamp down on speech. But the irony in the moment is it's really someone like Liz Cheney that would have the stronger First Amendment argument against the GOP, that she's just acting in her capacity as legislator and has to be able to speak freely about policy, than Donald Trump, who, and we're going to see this week, the carnage, as you indicate, was horrible. I mean, again, my people I know on the Capitol, they were cleaning up, human fecal material, urine and blood for days after, and notwithstanding, setting aside, broken glass, and lost lives. This was a horrible, horrible, horrible event. And the question is anyone other than the people that have been arrested for participating, many of whom have said publicly, listen, I was there for Donald Trump at his behest. I believed I was doing what he asked me to do. Should someone other than those people be held accountable? And many would say, listen, the office of the presidency should be to a higher standard, not a lower standard than regular people, particularly given the amount of power any president has when they're sitting in office, and Donald Trump did have on January 6th.
It's interesting to compare the first impeachment trial and now this one. The first one was about a phone call. We weren't privy to it. There weren't videos that we could look at. And I thought it was interesting. There's a new ABC News Ipsos poll. 56% of the American public believe that the president should be found guilty and be banished from holding office in the future. And I wonder, Kim, you mentioned the fact that this will not be a secret ballot. Just how much public pressure will be exerted on members of the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this with Watergate, right? I mean, Richard Nixon was not impeached because Republicans went to the White House and said, listen, public opinion has shifted. You need to resign. But things are really different now. I mean, one is the rise of social media and misinformation, something the framers were really worried about. It's why we have a republic. We don't have a direct democracy on the theory that, lies take hold faster than truths, and populism could make people to make decisions against their self-interest. And there are a lot of people that believed on January 6th and those, on the Capitol, believed that the election was fraudulent, which has no factual basis whatsoever. So I think given that and the fact that we're in such a polarized political environment where, years ago you might see a Democrat go after an incumbent Republican. Now you see Republicans primarying other Republicans. So, and Democrats primarying Democrats. So the competition is coming within the party. So, the 17 members of the Republican Senate who in theory might vote their conscience, might vote what's best for the American people and the Constitution, might vote based on the facts, all of those things say to themselves, listen, if I do that, I could lose my job to someone who's maybe more radical. So it's the best thing to do is to put my head down, vote for acquittal, and try to do what's best for the American people, rather than open this seat up to, frankly, I mean, we see with, I'm not going to mention names because I don't want to sort of to add to the publicity around this, but we see people that believe in, something as horrific and scary as QAnon that are now in major positions of power who won seats by large margins, in part because we are battling not just policy anymore, we're battling the existence of truth. And that's really a question for, not only for lawyers, but for, people within the realm of social media and the digital age, because it's really outmaneuvered basic legal principles, including the Constitution, on many, many levels. And I think that's what we're experiencing right now.
Well, Kim Whaley, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us something to think about as we listen and watch the upcoming impeachment hearing. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. A couple of comments here I would have loved to have squeezed on the air, but we will continue to follow this and probably, hopefully, do some more programs as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.